A very good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is number 064045, the Sierra Club against Franklin County Power. Mr. Dershowitz.
Thank you, Your Honor, and a good morning to you, too. My name is Nathan Dershowitz, and I represent the defendant appellants in this case. There are certain basic principles of standing which the Sierra Club and Judge Gilbert below either ignored or downplayed. As the Supreme Court recently reiterated in Massachusetts versus EPA, and then again Judge Alito in the case of Hine versus the Freedom of from Religious Foundation, that I'm sure Judge Ripple is well aware of, the court reiterated that Article 3 of the Constitution limits federal court jurisdictions to cases and controversies. The court went on to note that this limitation on power is critical to maintaining the tripartite allocations of powers between the different branches of government. The court also reiterated that no principle is more fundamental to the proper judicial role than limiting the courts to actual cases and controversies. There are three irreducible constitutional minimum standards that are required in order to satisfy the case and controversy requirement. The first is that there must be an injury in fact. The second is that there must be a causal connection between the injury and the actions by the party. And the third is that it must be redressable by a decision of the court. There must be injury in a concrete and a specific personal manner, and it must be imminent. It cannot be conjectural, and it cannot be hypothetical. The burden, of course, is on the plaintiff to establish it, and these are more than just pleading requirements. It goes to the merits of the case. It goes to a summary judgment motion. It goes to the requirements to prove it during the course of the case. And, of course, there is a separate independent obligation on the court to make its own evaluation of standing. Even if the parties didn't raise the issue, there's a separate obligation on the part of the court. And recently the Supreme Court addressed an issue of standing when it had not even been discussed by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in either the majority or the dissenting opinions. When an association brings an action, at least one of its members must satisfy the Article 3 requirements. Therefore, the member's injury must be real and imminent. The possibility of future injury is of no moment for purposes of satisfying the Article 3 requirements. Barbara McCassin, in her affidavits and deposition testimony, clearly shows that these allegations that she was raising were conjectural and they involve future possible injury.
You analogize that to the Lujan case, but isn't there a significant difference between those two cases?
Well, you know, here we have a situation where, let me just read you the two sentences from her deposition, where she says, has anything that Franklin Power has done up until today caused you any injury? The answer is no. Has anything that Franklin Power has said caused you any injury? The answer is no. That's on page A211. So you have no, in fact, injury to the one individual who had indicated that, or that was used by the district court for a determination with respect to standing. With respect to the other...
Yeah, but when you look at the Laidlaw case, it's not just actual use at the present time. And the plaintiff here indicated that she does use the affected area and that the value, the aesthetic and recreational value of the area will be lessened by the challenged activity. And Laidlaw said that's enough.
Only, Your Honor, Laidlaw is a different situation. Laidlaw, there had already been discharges of mercury into the water, which already had the effect. We don't question that those kinds of injuries are legitimate. The question is, are they actual injuries as opposed to potential down the road someday injuries? And someday injuries are not sufficient. Remember, no plant was built here yet.
Right.
No discharge had taken place.
But But Laidlaw, and I understand it was a slightly different factual scenario, but when you look at her situation, that it had the potential of affecting her and the value of the area would be lessened because there was no question that there was going to be some pollution. The question is just what's the level?
No, Your Honor. That is one minor part of the question. The core question is whether there was in fact any injury yet or whether the injury was sufficiently imminent to satisfy the case in controversy requirement. With respect to Laidlaw, of course there already had been discharges. There was already the polluting effect. The mercury was already in the water. So that is the classic distinction between Laidlaw and the subsequent Supreme Court cases and Lugin and all of the others.
So you're saying that threatened rather than actual injury cannot satisfy Article III standing?
Well, I think there's a question as to whether it can, and in fact, in Lugin, the court goes on to say if you're not an actual participant in the lawsuit, it's very hard to have standing. And if you look at the most recent two Supreme Court decisions, it is questionable whether imminent is sufficient. But we don't have imminent here. We have many years down the road injury. We have potential injury, and the injury, Your Honor, is theoretical. Because what she is saying is the difference between the back standard, and that is the standard of when the permit was issued versus at the time of the action. Let's assume, as in fact is the case, that the defendants actually produce less than the back standard, which they can.
Well, that was true in the old Duke Power case. It's one of the earlier cases. They allowed the plaintiffs to challenge the underlying congressional legislation that was going to insure the plant if, in fact, it was built. That seems to be far more attenuated in the situation we have here.
But I think if Your Honor looks at the, a lot more than the trend, it appears that the Supreme Court has been granting and hearing cases on standing more than in virtually any other area. And if you look at the most recent determinations by that court, it is clear that they read the requirements of actual injury quite restrictively, and they read the requirements for cases and controversies in a manner much more restrictive than it would appear to have been earlier.
Power has been restricted, at least sub silentio.
If you look at the most recent decision, Massachusetts versus EPA, it doesn't even mention Laidlaw, for example. If you look at the determination that was made in the Hine recent case, three of the justices made a distinction, but two of them sought to reverse Flass v. Cone, which is the one classic exception for a citizen's suit.
Taxpayer standing, which has always been sui generis.
But that's an exception that was sui generis, and two of the justices wanted to even reverse that sui generis extension.
He's asking us to put our finger to the wind as opposed to look at hard holdings here, which is
but the hard holdings in Massachusetts versus EPA is crystal clear. And if you read through the language in that decision, if you go through Daimler Chrysler, if you go through Hine, if you go through Lugin, it is clear that what the court is saying is there must be a specific actual injury that occurs. Both Justice Stevens for the majority and the Chief Judge in dissent in Massachusetts versus EPA both quoted Justice Kennedy's concurrence in Lugin and says that the requirement of actual harm is to ensure that the controversy is not resolved in, quote, the rarefied atmosphere of a debate society, but, quote, in concrete factual context conducive to a realistic appraisal of the consequences of judicial action. And what you have, for example, I'm not suggesting that the presidential debates are necessarily the rarefied atmosphere of a debate society, but if you look at the most recent, for example, Republican debates, you have Senator McCain taking a position of capping gas emissions, and you have ex-Mayor Giuliani and ex-Governor Romney saying that you have to come up with clean air technology. That is the kind of political debate that is appropriate for the political entities, namely the presidential and the Congress, and not for a determination by the courts. Certain kinds of political issues under the political question doctrine, as articulated in Baker versus Carr, are simply not justiciable. I think there's a quote from James Madison, which talks about the limitations on the court as being that which is justiciable, and therefore you need a case in controversy and not a political question at all.
What time lapse would be appropriate, would you think, between the proposed act and the potential damage before the courts could intrude themselves? They certainly don't have to wait until the pollution has occurred, do they?
Well, but there are remedial provisions within the section which allow
that.
For actions to be brought, which is what would have been appropriate in this situation. Because remember, one other standing, which also ties into the merits, is the fact that one of the core parties, the party that issued the permit in this case,
mm-hmm.
remember, this is not a case where there's no permit.
Right.
This is a case where the issue is the validity of the permit. The validity of the permit is a determination that is made preliminarily, mm-hmm. as well as subsequently by the administrative agency with an appellate procedure that goes with that. So Congress
has decided. Those things have to be exhausted before the federal courts have jurisdiction to enjoin?
On the question of the validity of a permit, definitely.
Yeah.
And you need the expertise of the administrative agency. And bear in mind also that we're in a position where the agency has the power to extend the permit. And that power is a very important power in these circumstances. We're dealing with a $750 million to $1 billion project. As a practical matter, there are extensive number of steps that must be taken, some of them well before the permit is issued, and some which have to be, which are after the permit is issued. Bear in mind that the IEPA never, until the Sierra Club became involved and put pressure on, had never said the permit was invalid. They had ruled up until a certain point that it was valid. They then said, we have reason to question it, come in and prove it.
Maybe I didn't make myself clear. You spoke in terms of the imminence of the threat to the danger. I want to know how imminent it has to be.
Well,
is it the ship sailing or what is it?
Well, you know, I think if someone is starting to dig, maybe that's imminent. If they're about to pollute, maybe that's imminent. But what you have here is you haven't even started, under their theory, the construction process. You haven't done any polluting at all.
So what you're saying is whatever it is, it's not now.
That's right. And there are cases which specifically use the language of, you know, the future problem or the general problem are clearly not sufficient for purposes of standing. And you also have, again, the prudential standing doctrine, which would appear to apply here. That was, in fact, a factor in Lugin. And that is you don't have the necessary expertise of the administrative agency involved in this litigation. You also, both in terms of the in terms of both of the standards for when commencement occurs, it's quite clear that the administrative agency is the entity that is in the best position to make the judgments as to whether you have, quote, a continuous program of actual on-site construction of the source. And you have within the record an extensive listing of the activities that had been going on up until that point. And again, the purpose of this provision is to make sure that you don't get a permit and sit on it so that you have a standard and you sit on it for a later date. If you're actively involved in all kinds of activities which are necessary and expensive activities, $30 million were spent here. The $72 million contract figure for damages is there because there was an anticipation of $72 million worth of work, preliminary part of this process work, in order to build the plant. So the agency knows that when you're dealing with a massive project of this type, the question is, what does it mean by a continuous program of actual on-site construction of the source? Does it mean site-specific? In other words, if you do the work on, as we did, you do all of the work for this specific Benton site. You spend an extensive amount of money on the Benton site. You are doing the water testing. You're building, you know, let's assume you're building the boiler. You're doing all of the work off-site only for this purpose, not a generic process. But for this purpose, does that satisfy the first part, the construction part? But our case is relatively simple on the merits, and that is you need to have entered into a binding agreement or actual obligations to undertake a program of actual construction of the source. If you read the contract, what occurred here is both the Sierra Club and Judge Gilbert looked at the contract and completely misunderstood the nature of the contract.
Well, let me ask you this. If the Sierra Club prevails on the suit, will FCPI owe Black & Veatch $72 million or some other amount of liquidated
damages? The
answer
is, under this contract, yes.
Yes.
Yes. And so what you have then is a clear contractual obligation.
Well, would you finish what you were saying, what the court overlooked?
Right. What the contract has in there, it's an actual construction contract. The language is clear to some extent as to exactly what is to be done is to build a project. There is also provisions in there for a next level of contract. So that they're going to enter into, that's a contractual obligation to then enter into that subsequent contract. That's what the court highlighted below, and that's what Sierra Club is pushing, but that's irrelevant. And the reason it's irrelevant is the question is this a contract to construct? And the answer is it's clearly a contract to construct. There is also, we will work in good faith to have the secondary contracts, the tertiary contracts, the contracts with the subs that need to be entered into. But if they don't, you still have a contract. So it's not a contract to contract in the future. It's a contract today, a binding contract today. We will work in good faith in order to come up with the subsequent contract.
You're in your rebuttal time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dershowitz. We'll hear now from Ms. Lohr.
May it please the Court. My name is Kira Lair, and I represent the Sierra Club. I want to step back for a moment and get to the reason of why we're here. We're here today because appellants are proposing to construct a 500-megawatt coal-fired power plant without a valid Clean Air Act permit, and we think that's not okay. I want to start today by describing the type of permit appellants' activity requires and by demonstrating how they let that permit expire. A person can't just build a large coal-fired power plant wherever or whenever he or she wants to, however he or she feels like it. The Clean Air Act has rules developers must follow before they can construct such a plant. The rules for the plant appellants propose to construct in southern Illinois require them to obtain a particular type of construction permit, known as a PSD permit, to prevent significant deterioration of the air quality in the area. Appellants submitted their request for a PSD permit from IEPA way back more than 7 years ago in August of 2000. And the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, or IEPA, issued them a permit way back in July 2001. As Mr. Dershowitz noted, you can't just sit on a PSD permit. They don't last forever. There are rules for their expiration. EPA's regulations state that if certain requirements are not met with respect to the permit automatically expires, and it becomes a violation of the Clean Air Act to propose to construct or to construct the power plant without that permit.
Is there a time limitation?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Is there a time limitation?
A time limitation? There's no time limitation written into the Clean Air Act.
So that it's up to that agency to make the determination?
No, it's not up to the agency at all to make the determination.
Who makes the determination?
A determination as to whether
a sufficient time has gone by so that the license no longer is valid or the permit is no longer valid.
Oh, there are rules regarding the 18-month timeline for when a permit expires. There are particular rules that you have to commence construction within 18 months. You can't discontinue construction for 18 months or more. And you have to complete construction within a reasonable time.
So on this hole and the digging of the hole, after the defendants began digging the second hole, because we had the first hole, and then there was a second hole, September 29th, the IEPA inspector visited the site and concluded that construction had commenced, right?
An investigator from IEPA made that conclusion, yes.
So if that constituted commencing construction, then why didn't the digging on January 8th, 2003 constitute commencing instruction?
One distinction is that in the J.M. Jones hole, the second hole, the one in October of 2004, they actually poured concrete at the base of that hole, which if you read the Reich memorandum, which the district court referred to as persuasive guidance for determining what these phrases mean, what it means to commence construction, what it means not to discontinue construction, they said that digging a hole, excavating a hole, and pouring concrete in the bowl, it is possible for that to form the basis for commencement of construction. We would submit that their activities in October 2004 still didn't meet that test, as IEPA also preliminarily determined 1 month after they went back to the site, took a look at it, and saw nothing happening.
Mr. Dershowitz talked about the fact that there was a binding contract, however. What's your view of that?
My view of the construction memorandum is very simple. It's an agreement between EnviroPower and Black & Veatch to work together to try to negotiate and draft an engineering, procurement, and construction contract. And that's what they've been doing in the 4.5 years since the agreement became effective.
$72 million penalty?
It's easy to throw those things in there if you're doing it against yourself, because that's what EnviroPower knew it needed in order to satisfy the portion. Let me step back for a moment and say what the test is. This is a binding agreement to undertake a program of actual construction which cannot be canceled or modified without substantial loss to the owner. What they did not get in the construction memorandum is a binding agreement to undertake a program of actual construction. It's an agreement to try to negotiate an agreement. And they have not yet been able to negotiate an agreement.
What does the term program of actual instruction mean?
In the begin actual construction language, it's a program of continuous actual on-site construction.
So the word program really is talking about actual construction, not a plan for construction?
Precisely. Because otherwise, there becomes no point to the regulations. If it's just about a plan, if it's just about a plan that can go on indefinitely, as long as you're diligently working as hard as you can on the plant doesn't actually get built within a reasonable time. And that's the reason the regulations exist, are so that plants, these coal-fired power plants that emit harmful pollutants into the air, get built in a reasonable length of time using the most current pollution controls available and taking into account the ambient air quality. It's why you can't just sit on them. It's why there are rules at all. If it were just about a plan, you'd never have an end point.
Why don't you speak to the standing question?
Certainly.
The council spent a lot of time on.
First off, the Supreme Court has repeatedly and for years held that a threatened injury is sufficient to confer standing. As the Gaston Copper, the Fourth Circuit, noted, the Supreme Court has consistently recognized that threatened rather than actual injury can satisfy Article III standing requirements. Mr. Dershowitz talked about Massachusetts v. EPA, one of the most recent Supreme Court decisions on this topic. And in that case, the court noted, EPA's steadfast refusal to regulate greenhouse gas emissions presents a risk of harm to Massachusetts that is both actual and imminent. If there is one thing appellants have done throughout this process, it's diligently proposed to construct this plant. 2 days after the district court issued its opinion granting summary judgment to Sierra Club, appellants issued a press release where they stated their intention to complete construction of the plant. They have every intention of constructing this plant, as they have told this court and every court repeatedly, and Mrs. McCassin and the Sierra Club should not have to wait until the plant is operating and emitting harmful pollutants until it may bring suit. Challenge the validity of the permit.
Why don't you also speak about whether or not the injury is redressable? Because we have a situation that if you prevail here, the defendants need to get a new permit, which that new permit may have stricter air control, quality control regulations in it. And so, but it's very likely it's not going to reduce all pollution. You know, so
that's
there
true.
Will still be some pollution. And so isn't that something we have to consider?
Less pollution is better than more pollution, and there will be less pollution. The IEPA has consistently lowered the emission rates allowable for these type of coal-fired power plants.
But then if it's lowered, then it may address her concerns. It may address her concerns in terms of her fears about going to the site or fishing and that kind of thing.
That's right. Requiring them to get a new permit would redress her fears. Because the emissions, and I'd like to actually talk about the emission rates and how much lower they have. IEPA has been making them in the past several years, in the 6 years, 6.5 years now since EnviroPower got its permit. Just 2 years after EnviroPower got its permit, the IEPA considered a coal-fired power plant using the same type of technology as EnviroPower has proposed, and they drastically dropped all of the emission rates. They took the emission rate for nitrogen oxide, cut it by 20%, cut sulfur dioxide by 40%, volatile organic compounds by 43%, mercury, which McKesson is especially concerned about, cut by 50%, and carbon monoxide by 59%. These decreases have continued, and that will have a significant impact on Mrs. McKesson's health.
And I think it took them about a year to get the permit before, or under a year.
Is about 11 months.
What, just from a practical standpoint, is that still the time frame?
As far as I know, approximately. I mentioned earlier the three ways that a PSD permit can automatically expire. It's if you fail to commence construction within 18 months, and there's two ways you can do that. And if you fail to discontinue construction for a period of 18 months or more.
Can I just go back for a minute on the $72
sure.
million? Dollars? Is it your view that if Sierra Club prevails, that FCPI will owe Black & Veatch $72 million or some amount of liquidated damages?
I have no idea. On its face, the construction memorandum says it's already expired. It said it expired November 30th, 2005. Technically, at that point, $72 million should have been due. Mr. Dershowitz didn't indicate that they've paid it or that they've been asked for it. It's hard to say exactly what that construction memorandum does, but it's easy to say what it doesn't do. What it isn't is an agreement to build this plant. I think the district court actually said it very well when they said, if you consider, could EnviroPower sue Black & Veatch for failing to build this plant under the construction memorandum? And there's not one term in the agreement that would let that suit prevail. Back again to the three tests. Regardless of whether they commenced construction within 18 months, and clearly they haven't, either the actual construction prong or the binding agreement prong, they also discontinued construction-like activities for a period of 18 months or more, which is the second way that a permit automatically expires. The hole dug by Alberici in January of 2003, they stopped digging that on February 10th, 2003. Now, I think it was about July 2004 that the owners of the land filled that hole in, and then it wasn't until late September, early October 2004, more than 19 months later, that J.M. Jones started digging the second hole. There simply was no construction activity between those 19 months, which is an automatic violation of the requirement not to discontinue construction.
Can you speak to the permanent injunction that was issued here and the whole issue of the district court not really setting out those four factors that are required for a permanent injunction, going through them?
Well, as this court has noted in the past, in U.S. v. Bethlehem Steel and in EPA v. Environmental Waste Control, it's not always necessary to run through the four-part test for an injunction. In this case, the court examined the undisputed facts, laid them out in its opinion, and determined that appellants violated the Clean Air Act by constructing this power plant without a valid permit.
Well, let me ask you, the court has said that you don't have to meet the four-part test if there's a willful violation. Was there any evidence provided here of willful conduct?
I would point to the memorandum from Joseph Dargousis back in December of 2002 as an evidence of willfulness. When responding to a request by the CEO of EnviroPower to look into how they can maintain the validity of their air permit, they came up with the ideas of pour a truckload of construction or get a new air permit, and then immediately started scrambling to do just that. The district court, contrary to appellant's statement in their reply brief when they said the district court did not discuss the Dargousis memorandum, actually on page 28 of the district court's opinion, it did mention the Dargousis memorandum, quoted the excerpt that it was not possible to enter into a binding construction agreement before January 3, 2003, and said that was evidence that EnviroPower was aware at that time that they had problems with this air permit.
But there's no indication by the court that their conduct was willful, like in these other cases where the waiver of the four-part test has been upheld. You know, we have situations where the builder goes ahead and builds the plant in the face of regulations or in the face of warnings or in the face of the EPA saying, don't do this, don't do this, and they do it, and so it's willful, and the court never has to reach it. But we don't even have a willful finding here. And the court doesn't really provide sufficient evidence of willfulness. I mean, you've pointed out this one thing, but is that enough for willfulness when we're talking in the context of a permanent injunction?
Well, and if you also look at the balancing of the harms in this case, they fully concede they've built nothing. They
right.
said, let's assume we're building the boilers. They're not. There's nothing in the record that they're building the boilers. They have no contract for the boilers. At this stage of the game, where the district court found defendants' activity to be a clear violation of the Clean Air Act, and it's not like the plant is almost done and completed construction, then the balancing would weigh in favor of a permanent injunction. And it's not a permanent injunction against building the plant ever. You just have to go back and get a new permit. The district court didn't say, you are never allowed to build this plant. Just go and comply with the Clean Air Act's requirements, go get a new permit, and go back to what you were doing.
Right, but the court didn't, in the record, do such a balancing test as you've, or such balancing as you've suggested.
It did not explicitly do that balancing. Unless the court has any more questions, I'd like to turn to my conclusion, where we ask this court to affirm the lower court's decision in its entirety, to find that Sierra Club has standing, that the court had jurisdiction, that summary judgment was appropriately granted to Sierra Club, and the district court had the authority to enjoin appellants from engaging in actual construction of the plant unless they get a new permit. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Lehrer. How much time does Mr. Dershowitz have? Thank you.
Judge Williams, let me address your questions, the final questions, and then I'll go back to some of the other questions. First, bear in mind that this was a summary judgment motion. There was no hearing, no factual determinations made. So for the Sierra Club to point to something in the record which could possibly support a possible conclusion is grossly inappropriate. And that pervades this whole presentation that's been made. Factual issues are ignored. There are factual issues pervading the case, and they act as if all they need to do is articulate something, and therefore it is a conclusion for purposes of summary judgment. That is simply not correct. That applies to the alleged harm, for example. It's in an affidavit. There is a deposition. We have a right to a hearing. We have a right to a trial on that issue, as the Supreme Court has made clear on the issue of standing and other issues. In any event, there is no finding here of any gross impropriety which would support skipping the necessary balancing test, and I am not sure that the balancing test, the situations where you don't need the balancing test articulated by this court, survive the recent Supreme Court decision of eBay, where even in a patent case, the court held that you need to do the four-part balancing test. There has never been a desire and claim that this project will be built without a permit. It has always been a claim that there will be a permit, that there is a valid permit. So to the extent that the claim is it's imminent, if we are building without a permit or a valid permit, there is no intention to proceed. We claim that there is a valid permit. A determination has been made by the agency that the permit is valid. They then sent a note saying there are questions about that, giving us an opportunity to respond to that. We responded to it. It is inherently within the agency's area where it, in fact, was located. There was a hearing that there were determinations that had to be made by the agency. We were stripped of our right to proceed in that manner, and instead, even though it's an agency determination, it was pulled out of the agency, and the court made the determination. With respect to the statutory provisions, the regulations, my adversary repeatedly ignores the fact that the provision says the administrator may extend the 18-month period upon a satisfactory showing that an extension is justified. So we were in a position where we said the permit is valid. We were before the agency. If the agency determined, for example, that the permit, that we hadn't satisfied the two requirements for commencing construction, which we don't believe they would have done, but had they done that, we could have then sought the discretionary extension. And we were precluded from seeking the discretionary extension, which is only an administrative agency's power. So you cannot simply say these provisions are self-operating. They're not self-operating. They require an administrative agency determination. And Judge Williams, just
ask you this. Has a new PSD permit been applied for?
No, it has not. And the reason for that is clear. We're talking about a lengthy delay process. We're talking about an 18-month process. We're talking about a complex transaction where you work out the financing on the basis of certain permits. And it's not like building a house. You have to do everything.
But I mean, the last time it took less than a year to get the PSD when you look at the length of time for this litigation. Right. I just raise that as a practical question. Would that have been easier to just get?
And the answer is no. But in terms of the other question on standing that you asked, if I can just answer that one, and that is if we come in as we intend to with the most efficient, updated actions now, we can come in below even the today's back standards. And if we do that, there is not and cannot be any harm. In other words, the claim is that there's a distinction between the date of the permit and today. If, in fact, we build a plant which emits lower than even today's standard, that eliminates any claim of injury. And so that's why I say it's a theoretical in response to Your Honor's question. The injunction then prevents us from proceeding, and there is no harm, because the harm is the claimed distinction between old back standard, new back standard. If we satisfy the new back standard, as we intend to do, then of course there can be no injury to someone who wants to go once every 2 years to a lake or lives 45 miles away from the site. Thank you very much.
The court wants to thank both Mr. Dershowitz and Ms. Lehr for their very fine briefs in this case and for their very fine oral argument today. In the case